There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the 45th Podcast. I'm here with Siraj. Rabia is out this week. And we're here to discuss how the first week of 2018 is going.
It was lit, fam. It was the most lit week.
Is that the word for it?
To start 2018 ever. I can't imagine any week after this being as phenomenal as this one. Can you, Susan?
How do you define the word phenomenal? Just curious.
Just in terms of the news cycle, the amount of things that are going on, the pettiness that's going on. I mean, if you wanted both policy and just wildly entertaining political drama, this week had it all.
I want that in a TV show.
Yeah, well, it would be great for a TV show, but it's even better when it's happening in real life.
It's terrifying what's happening in real life.
Oh, I mean, yeah, there's things you can laugh at. As a journalist, this is one of the most entertaining weeks of the Trump presidency I've ever experienced.
Even Scaramucci week?
I don't think Mooch week can top this. And Mooch was 10 days.
Yeah. So it's the best week, but the best Scaramucci.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if this is the best Scaramucci, because there's still maybe three more days before we can say it's a Scaramucci of the new year. By the time I'm sure this goes out, it'll have been a Scaramucci, and we will see in the next, since this is a Sunday we're recording, these next few days will be kind of crucial. But
well, it definitely got off with a bang.
Yeah.
The end of 2017 went a bit slow. Trump tweeted that he was getting back to work on Christmas the next day, and then golf for 7 days.
Yeah.
Things were a lot. I love that period. He was golfing. Nothing really happened. There was never like a fear of like, oh God, things really are falling apart.
Yeah. That comparatively speaking, before and after New Year's, the weeks before and after New Year's were just completely different in terms of how slow it was beforehand and how fast everything got, where I just could not keep up. And it was just, it was amazing by just how much there was going on. And I was actually amazed that the week after Christmas before New Year's was as slow as it was, because I thought, under this Trump presidency, anything's possible. Just like,
when he's on the golf course, it's magical.
Yeah, I guess we just keep him out on the golf course.
Yeah, where he can't be seen. I love how someone hired a white truck to block CNN's views of him golfing.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, I remember that. That was pretty dumb. I mean, I will admit.
Well, he's planted trees there now, so now it's a permanent shield to see.
I mean, everybody knows he's golfing. What is he trying to hide at this point?
I think it's like one of the few moments of self-awareness Trump has, where he can't actually quite rewrite history enough to forget that he spent 8 years making fun of Obama for golfing.
Yeah.
So most stuff he can like remember like the way he wants it to. With this one, he's like, oh yeah, I did that. I should hide this.
Yeah. So how did this whole week play out? I know that we have a lot of things to discuss. What should we start off with?
Let's start with the worst tweet.
Okay. What was the worst tweet?
The worst tweet was the one where he starts baiting a nuclear power on Twitter for no goddamn reason.
Well, that was just really dumb to start off with. I don't think it was a dangerous tweet. I just think it was like, I don't know what Kim Jong-un has in North Korea if he has access to Twitter. I'm sure his aides get word of this and then forward it to him. But like, Trump is going to say whatever he wants to say, and there's nothing Kim Jong-un can do about it.
Every leader in the free world is getting like daily updates on Trump tweets.
Yeah,
in the world is like on edge. They have their staff like, okay, who's my intelligence officer in charge of the tweets?
I have on my phone alerts to every Trump tweet. So like, yeah.
Oh God, I don't do that. I can't. If I don't see it live, I'm letting it slide by.
Oh, I mean, some people need to maintain their sanity. I find some comfort in knowing that the president will never stop tweeting.
Well, this tweet, to get some context, over the new year, Kim Jong-un gave a speech, and you know, in an attempt to bait the United States and scare everyone, made this comment about how he has a red button, or just a button, although it was red, but definitely in his head he meant a red button because they're always red, on his desk ready to push at any time. And other than just being the empty bellicose talk that it should have been taken as, Trump sees it on Fox and tweets out, quote, "North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on his desk at all times. Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I too have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his, and my button works."
Yeah, and what's funny is that I think everybody lampooned that, saying that that's the button that orders him a Diet Coke.
I mean, that's the only one he has that works, so. I mean, first off, if you're calling it a button, you've already lost.
Yeah. I mean,
and second, this is like a total bonanza for feminist theory and national security.
Oh, yeah, with the whole Matt Lauer thing. I made a joke about the whole Matt Lauer button under his desk.
I just mean the idea that like all of like 20th century and starting off 21st century international relations, the dick size contest. And
that too. I immediately thought of Spaceballs, you know, with the final scene between Dark Helmet and Bill Pullman's character, and they were comparing each other's Schwartz ring size. Like, I see your Schwartz is bigger than mine, or is as big as mine. Let's see how you handle it.
That's all it is. I mean, I think this one was self-aware to some extent. That was an intentional analogy, which does make the use of the button as the metaphor a bit more perplexing. But just not... I mean, this tweet itself, no, is not going to send us a nuclear war. But this kind of rhetoric is dangerous overall. I mean, it's hard not to read this and think, oh, God, this guy is kind of unstable. Maybe it's possible he would just ridiculously bomb someone because he's having a bad Twitter day. And that's when you have miscalculations start, and that's how wars start.
Yeah, but that's what you have your advisors for. That's what you have, you know, John Kelly. You have H.R.
You don't listen to him, though. He's not listening to him. Like, that's not going to stop war.
I think when it comes to the suicide pact that they have set up, along with Rex Tillerson, you know, any faulty move that President Trump makes, and they're gone. And I think Trump realizes he needs them more than they need him.
They can leave if he pushes the button, but
I don't know. I think Trump in many ways is a loose cannon, but I think when it comes to nuclear weapons, I think he might be a little bit more restrained than he's letting on.
I agree, but it's not him I'm really worried about. It's the fact that North Korea, I mean, okay, let me rephrase that entirely. I am worried about him. I am not so much worried about him launching a preemptive nuclear attack, but I am worried that we're creating conditions where war will happen, whether anyone wants it or not. I don't think anyone actually wants nuclear war. I mean, they definitely don't want nuclear war to happen, but that doesn't mean it still can't happen.
Well, yeah, obviously, but I mean, of course, I could be completely wrong about all of this, and, you know, President Trump launches a nuke after we stop recording this. I mean, but again, I don't think that that is, you know, of the things he wants to be remembered for. I mean, this is a guy who's, you know, very self-centered, very narcissistic, and he cares a lot about what people think about him, and he will get absolutely destroyed in the media if he were to launch a nuke. And that's, I think, might be the one thing, as crazy as that sounds, that might be the one thing that holds him back.
That's not the real danger here. There's a great article, and if you haven't read it, check it out, by Jeffrey Lewis on Here's What a War with North Korea Would Look Like, where it lays out the scenario about how missteps on each side can lead to a war neither side wanted. And it's kind of shockingly believable. It also includes a Trump tweet, of some hypothetical Trump tweet at some point that says, Little Rocket Man won't be around for much longer, which I could totally see him tweeting. But at the same time, you could totally see how Kim Jong-un would take that as an actual threat to his, you know, existence as the leader of a country, or, you know, existence, period.
Yeah, and but I don't think North Korea would preemptively launch a nuclear strike because their survival is based on them not launching a strike.
You should check the article out and see
I'll do you a solid and I'll check it out.
Especially though, with nuclear weapons, it's not the kind of thing where you're like, it's probably okay. The president of America is taunting North Korea for no goddamn reason on Twitter all the time.
Well, I guess it's a good sign that, you know, South Korea and North Korea reopening up peace talks, which I've already seen President Trump take credit for, if That's, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes. Yes. So North Korea and South Korea have resumed talks about the Olympics. And I think there's possibly talks that North Korea's delegation may join South Korea because they only have like two figure skaters who made the cut. But now Trump, of course, is like, do you think that they'd be talking? If it wasn't for me tweeting out mean things. Like, and what like kind of like mediocre white man view of the world is that? Like, you think the whole complicated situation, like, you know, nuclear war with North Korea can be handled if you just get on Twitter and start writing angry things?
Hey, it works for him so far. but
some other tweets this week we had addressing what happened in Iran.
Yeah, so let's see. I can't fully recall all the tweets that he sent out, but
they were also don't seem exactly like Trump tweets. It seems like an aide probably wrote most of them, but there were quite a few of them.
Yeah, you're probably right. I'm pulling up one right now that happened within the last week because he essentially, it was obviously being very supportive of the Iranian protests. And it sounds like he wants regime change. Ah, from 5 days ago, and this would have been January 2nd. So that's on Tuesday. The people of Iran are finally acting against the brutal and corrupt Iranian regime. All of the money that President Obama so foolishly gave them went into terrorism and into their, quote, pockets, end quote. The people have little food, big inflation, and no human rights. The U.S. is watching. So that's, he sent out several tweets, but like that's the latest one.
But as someone pointed out, and I cannot like remember who it is now, and I apologize. As president, Trump has tweeted the phrase human rights exactly 4 times, and every single time applied to Iran.
Yeah, I don't think they're interested so much in human rights as they are in regime change.
I don't think Trump's interested in human rights except as a bludgeon to try and attack Iran with. I mean, no one is, that's so transparent, no one's fooled by it. He does not care about human rights. He cares about finding some kind of edge to,
I think people will be more open to and more willing to go to, at least within the United States, conservatives and Republicans would be more willing to go to war with Iran than they are with North Korea, just because there is a, there are a lot more interests at stake, at least with respect to Iran, considering the fact that one of the U.S.'s closest allies, Saudi Arabia, in the Middle East, is seeking hegemony in the region, and Saudi Arabia would probably push for something like that to try to weaken Iran as much as they possibly can. So, yeah, that's a conundrum right there, and I don't think, you know, some outlets have said the protests are essentially over. I don't think that they're over. I think they're still going on, but the U.S. has just gotten bored with covering them, just because it's been pretty stagnant. And, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei and President Hassan Rouhani, they initially were very critical of the protests. They've had security forces kill close to 24 protesters, and it's just not a pretty situation there. And I don't know if anything's going to get done unless the U.S. intervenes. And I cannot, honestly, reality-wise, I cannot see that happen. But we'll keep an eye on it, and if President Trump does anything, we will definitely be discussing it. Does your business have any New Year's resolutions? Here's an important one every business should consider. Make your hiring process more efficient and effective. This year, let ZipRecruiter help. No one has done a better job of transforming how you find the right talent than they have.
Yeah, if you're trying to hire, if you're trying to find the best candidates, you could waste a lot of time looking at a lot of places, trying to find the people you need. Or you could go to ZipRecruiter.
ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click.
So you don't have to waste time posting everywhere. Just go there and you can hit all the people out there that you want to hit.
They even review every application to identify the top candidates so you never miss a great match.
Yeah, especially for small businesses and as a podcaster now, something I do is trying to sort through all the administrative issues we go through. And hiring can be a huge time suck. But with ZipRecruiter, they'll identify the most qualified candidates for you and invite them to apply to your position.
No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day.
So find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to help find the best qualified candidates with immediate results.
And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/45.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/45. And one more time, to try it free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/45.
ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This past week, the Trump administration said on Thursday that it would allow new offshore drilling, both oil and gas, in nearly all United States coastal waters, giving energy companies access to leases off California for the first time in decades, and opening more than 1 billion acres in the Arctic and along the eastern seaboard. And that basically ends an Obama-era policy in which, you know, pretty big deal to environmental organizations. It's a pretty big blow to them. And, I mean, I see it obviously as an effort for the U.S. to become more energy independent. But, you know, what we saw in 2010 with the Deepwater Horizon, and it was leaking oil into the Gulf of Mexico and going along the Gulf Coast for close to, 100 days before it finally stopped.
Yeah. And they also rolled back the tax on, you know, oil companies for dealing with cleanups.
Yeah.
So another tax break.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's scary because these are things that can be rolled back or at least like altered later on. But that's not true. I was going to say, I don't think anyone agrees that it's best to have a totally unregulated oil industry and to let these spills happen unchecked. But I guess the Republicans kind of do believe that.
I don't know. I think this is this is one of those areas where they just don't want to buy foreign oil, and I don't think they wanted their gas dependent on what Saudi Arabia was telling them the cost of a barrel of oil was going to be. So,
we're friends now, so it's all good.
Yeah, I know, but still, when it comes to trade, I mean, that's still like one of the things that, you know, they still had control over us. But, you know, since they opened up ANWR, the Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge, and I mean, there was drilling going on in the North Dakota, in the Dakotas, as you know, during the Obama administration, and that started happening. I want to say in 2013 or 2014. I'm not exactly sure on the date, but that at least started helping with reducing energy prices throughout the country.
Trump himself has no real conception of like what the interests here are, or like how to balance them, or what the downsides might be. He just seems to be like full throttle, like, yeah, let's just drill everything, get all the oil, and
I mean,
forget all the lefties.
I guess, I mean, like, I am for the U.S. being more energy independent. I do.
But you're not in favor of stripping away all regulations for, like, offshore drilling, which is what these guys seem to be right now.
Essentially. I mean, I do think that some regulation is better than absolutely no regulation. There has to obviously be rules, and these companies abide by it to make sure that we don't have another Deepwater Horizon or any more oil leaks, because I don't think the U.S. can afford another gas spill like that, nor can the environment.
Yeah, and the gold economy can't handle it either.
So, anyways, moving on, we got this past week, President Trump has been focused highly on getting $18 billion for his border wall. And that comes with doing a deal with the Democrats over the deferred action for childhood arrivals policy and whether to extend it. It expires in March, and it's one of those key deals that are really up in the air, because if Democrats don't do a deal on DACA and Trump doesn't get his deal on the border wall.
Let's not call it a deal. It's a hostage negotiation.
Well, it's interesting to think of this because it's 800,000 DACA recipients, or dreamers, if you want to call them that, who came to this country as children. Some of them are young adults, and it's, you know, temporary amnesty, and basically, you know, who really has the upper hand in this negotiation? Because, you know, the Democrats can easily obstruct. They could basically say, no, we're not going to give you the wall, and you're not going to do anything on DACA. And it's possible that Trump reauthorizes DACA without getting a border wall funding.
It's more complicated, though, because I think it is a hostage negotiation. Trump has made hostages.
Why do you think it's a hostage situation?
Engineered this by destroying, like, he could have kept rules in place, and he decided to nuke them. Bad choice of words again. So now the DACA, like, that was not an issue, but he forced this in order to give himself a bargaining position. There would not have been a danger if he hadn't taken any action, but he did. So you can't intentionally put 800,000 people's lives at risk. Mm-hmm. And then claim it's the other side's fault for not saving them. And also, I think he may have miscalculated here, because I think that there is, among Republicans, I mean, so Democrats are unified, I think. I don't know if there's any exceptions. They are unified and wanting to have something to fix it, what's happened here with DACA. But Republicans aren't really unified behind either the wall or ending DACA. Some are totally gung-ho about it, but there is a lot of squishiness there.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of Republicans are interested in deporting 800,000 Dreamers.
And they're not really that, you know, excited about paying $18 billion for a joke of a wall.
Especially when President Trump basically ran on the platform of making Mexico pay for it.
Yeah. What happened to that? So, again, like, there is obviously Trump's going to try and spin it as, how dare the Democrats try and risk these 800,000 lives by not immediately agreeing to all my demands. But that's not, I mean, yes, there's a risk here, but you can't simply say, okay, every time you threaten something, we'll give you like a million, like whatever you want, and then some.
Yeah.
And I think they're very, like, they have to actually push back against this idea that they are forced to save everyone Trump tries to kill.
Yeah. Well, I don't like to mention the fact that I go on TV, but I went on TV on CNN, and they asked me about CNN knew Dan Sundev. I'll post a link to it. I mean, if you watch it, great. If you're not, I don't care either.
You should totally go watch it.
But they were asking me about DACA, and what my initial thoughts were was that whatever Trump gets done on it, whether he gets anything done, he will be able to spin it in a positive way that makes him look like the good guy. So if he's able to get a deal on the border wall, he'll say that he got his funding for the border wall and border security, and, you know, he's the greatest president ever. Boom. End of story. If he's not able to get the border wall deal, and he's, you know, he doesn't extend or doesn't reauthorize DACA, he'll be able to blame the Democrats for being obstructionists, and that could hurt them in the midterms in terms of turnout. So either way, right now, I think Trump does have the upper hand.
But that's kind of portraying as like a pure like words battle. Like it's there's winners and losers about like who gets the policy without actually looking at the policies themselves. I mean, there's a reason that a lot of people don't want the wall and do want DACA fixed, because there are serious policy consequences that affect millions of lives. And I don't think he can win here the way he set this up. And again, I'm not certain. I think Democrats are right that they don't think there's enough Republican support for killing DACA that they have to roll over here. Plus, Trump has like definitely split his base. If he does get the wall and fixes DACA, he's not going to, the base is going to hate that. They're like, wait, we want to kick all them out.
I think
a wall with them on the inside.
I think it'll be bittersweet for them, because they might call him Amnesty Don for a minute before they realize that they actually got the wall. And that will be probably the thing that will keep, I mean, like, it's 800,000.
The wall that does nothing.
It's 800,000 DACA recipients out of 330 million Americans that live in this country. That's small potatoes considering the fact that if you're able to stop illegal border crossings or end chain migration or end the visa lottery system, that's more wins in Trump supporters' books than, say, reauthorizing DACA. I think a lot of Trump supporters understand that you're not going to get everything. I mean, let's be real. Trump's, you know, his theme song that has been played at every single campaign rally.
Oh, God, I hate that.
The Rolling Stones. You can't always get what you want, but you get what you need.
It's the dumbest thing to play.
But in this case, it's very applicable, because they may not want to get everything that they want, but they might get everything that they need. And that will probably be, you know, Trump's saving grace right there.
On the other hand, if DACA does not get renewed, and again, there's already people being deported who did not get this. So there's a big old snafu with people trying to do the early renewal of their DACA permits. And the mail didn't get delivered. They're submitted on time, but someone in the post office forgot to like bring in like one big bag of submissions. So they didn't make the deadline, and those people are getting deported right now. But if DACA does not get renewed, it's just not like, oh, it just affects them. It affects the entire economy. 800,000 people is a lot of people. And if we put them into crisis, had them deported, and again, they have the whole list of their names and identity and where they are. If they use that, oh my God. But just this uncertainty hurts the economy. Like, this has real effects on all of us.
And, you know, Trump is not going to deport 11.3 million unauthorized immigrants living here in the United States. I mean, it's only 800,000 DACA recipients, but think of the many millions more who are here and they don't have papers. So,
but they have how to find the people who are in DACA. It's the easiest way of attacking immigrants they wanted to. Anyway, I don't see it as being like a win-win for Trump like you do. I think that this is a I think he.
I guess in the spin cycle, that's the only where I could see, only way I could see it's a win-win. I think a lot of people in the media would probably report it as you've probably described it. But
like, to play your cards right, you have to know what your cards are.
But the only thing is, like, the trust in media has been at such a low point, particularly among Trump's base, that they won't trust anything the media has to say about it. They'll only trust what Donald Trump has to say about it, and that's why I say it's a win-win, at least for a third of the population, all of whom supported Trump.
So, Siraj, guess what's happening tomorrow?
Tomorrow is in Monday.
Yeah.
What's happening?
The fake news awards.
Oh yeah.
Oh my God. This is so embarrassing.
And Trump's going to the national championship game, a college football national championship. It's going to be lit.
Wait, who are you cheering for exactly?
I'm not an Alabama or Georgia fan. I actually probably don't like Alabama more, so I'll root for Georgia.
Okay, cool. We can keep going.
Yeah, no, I've never been an Alabama fan. I'm a Patriots fan, though, so I guess that kind of disqualifies me from ever having an opinion on anything relating to sports.
It is possible to be an okay person and be a Patriots fan. It's not common, but it does happen.
I mean, like, I grew up in New England, so, like, what do you want me to do?
Yeah, that's fine.
Not root for my home teams?
But, yeah, there's only one answer for tomorrow, just FYI.
Okay. Did you go to Georgia?
No, but a lot of my family did.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. At least you got a good connection there. Familial connection. So, fake news awards. Who's it going to? Who's a top contender?
I have to go to Trump himself, if we're being honestly.
Yeah, but it's going to be tough for him to give an award to somebody who's not himself. But
I hope to God the media is not a 10 there. That would be the worst.
I don't know. I think what's going to happen is going to be like a live stream thing where he's done in the past. He had that like Trump TV for a little bit before Fox News went all in and became basically state-run media.
Yeah, but why appear at your own ritual humiliation? The media should just stay away. Yeah. And pretend this whole farce isn't happening.
No, they wouldn't. But, I guess that brings up the case of Michael Wolff in the book he wrote, because he made the strongest push in the past week for being the top contender or the favorite to win the fake news award.
Yeah, a late-breaking contender. After the fake news awards were announced, the Michael Wolff book came out, and, like, geez, that's not fair. No one else has a chance now. When it comes to bras, fit is everything, which is why shopping for bras can be such a hassle. You have to go in and try on 1,000,006 bras until you find one that finally works. Now, though, there's a new company that changes all that, and it's called Third Love. They're the only lingerie brand that offers bras in sizes AA through G, as well as half cup sizes. Did you know that old school bra brands only carry 15 sizes? Well, Third Love has 60 sizes, including half cups. Never heard of them? That's because no one else does it. But Third Love knows that there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now, they're offering our listeners 15% off your first order. To find the bra that you've been waiting for all your life, all you have to do is answer a few questions from Third Love's Fit Finder quiz. It just takes 60 seconds, and you can do it from the comfort of your own home. So try a Third Love bra. It's so comfortable, you might forget you're wearing it. And if you don't agree, returns and exchanges are always easy and free. This year, make the change that will change the way you think about bras. Go to thirdlove.com/45th. That's thirdlove.com/45th and find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first order when you use our code. That's thirdlove.com/45th. Let's turn to the fire and the fury.
The fire and fury inside the Trump White House. So yeah, I know you weren't going to read it, but you read it.
I did. I was like, oh, I would know. I was like, I'm not going to read this stupid book. I've seen it on Twitter anyway. And then I'm like, I have a podcast in 45th. I probably am obligated to read it. So I read it, or most of it. I read the majority of an article. I read a lot of it. The parts of it, honestly, I'll say straight out, I don't think it's a very great book. Occasionally, Michael Wolff has like really good lines, and you're like, oh, where'd that come from? Because most of it's pretty boring. He called Trump the clown prince at one point. I laughed. but... you know, it's just kind of a book. It's really boring, a lot of it, because it's all stuff that we already know.
Keep going. But like that, I agree with you on that. It's like everything on there is probably what we suspected.
Yeah. I mean, if you've been following it closely and you know the general gist, there's very little that's totally new, and the stuff that is new, you kind of assumed.
Yeah.
Like you said. And it's also got problems. Like, okay, first off, my big problem with it is it's a very, very shallow take on everything. It's a gossip mag. It's a, like a, here's like the, individual interactions that were really titillating and scandalous and what happened with them, without focusing on like the bigger issues. But then again, as I'm saying that, I'm like, maybe there aren't any bigger issues here. Maybe there's not like a deeper layer to the White House. Maybe all of it is this surface gossip, and that's all you can report on because that's all there is.
You know, I thought long and hard about this as well. And, you know, after talking to some of my colleagues at the Washington Examiner, you know, I think we all came to this similar conclusion that, you know, can you really trust White House sources who are known for lying? And then President Trump, who is also known for lying and now he has surrounded himself with liars, and be able to take this book at face value, knowing that everyone's pretty much lying about each other and trying to elevate their own personal platforms in order to make themselves look the best out of the Trump administration. And that's kind of essentially what you have here. Is like, it's a book full of lies about each other. There's some, maybe some truth to it, but how much of it are you really going to take at face value? And another point that I just want to make is that if you believe that, for example, that everyone on Trump's campaign didn't think that Donald Trump should be president or should have been president, it's hard to buy the narrative that they colluded with the Russians. Because why would you collude with the Russians if you fundamentally believe that he should have not been president?
Well, that's probably easy because you don't want to lose so bad, and also you want to position yourself as like a valid contender. And also the real deal is like you want to encourage your connections with financial backers over in Moscow.
I mean,
I don't necessarily buy that. I don't buy that take necessarily. They actually thought, I do believe they thought they were going to lose. I don't believe they intended to lose. But the whole thing is just like American criminology here.
I mean,
like,
they did everything they could. Honestly, if you think about it, the Trump campaign literally did everything they possibly could have done to try to lose that election, yet still won. Like, if you look at like every single misstep that the Trump campaign made, really just centering around President, you know, Donald Trump's behavior.
Like, it's not like the campaign really like just, I mean, every like, fuck up Trump made, yeah.
Every single thing that they've done is pretty much the key way to lose, yet he still won. And that's the most mind-boggling.
I will forever believe that the media's like horse race approach has destroyed American politics because they need a horse race. You could put like, you could put Sassy, Roy Moore's horse on the ballot up against like the ghost of Jefferson. And they would find a way to be like, well, Sassy is a really, she's new to politics, but she's got some ideas that are really striking core voters. Like they're gonna like falsely balance that shit all day long so they actually have something to talk about. And it doesn't matter how terrible you are, you're gonna get that normalizing bump and that handicap that puts you somewhere in the ballpark.
Hey, you might. You're probably right about that.
That's the thing,
a fresh face in politics is not oftentimes the best thing you can do. But then again, you know, Trump has been around the block for a while. He's floated with running in the past, despite the fact that he claims that this, you know, the 2016 run was his first try.
I mean, there's no objective comparison whatsoever between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Donald Trump is an idiot who is overly emotional, a liar, has no knowledge of any relevant skills. His only trait is appealing to, you know, the racist base.
Mm-hmm.
There's in no objective world could you actually compare those two quantities and be like, yeah, we can actually make this a race between two things.
Yeah.
I mean, and yeah, yet they presented that way in the news. So I think despite all of his missteps, that wouldn't hurt him. It wouldn't hurt anyone as it should. And Trump has a very unique way of surviving that kind of stuff. So I think that's also partially just him. But
that's why he's called Teflon Don.
Yeah. If you have no shame and no knowledge of your own limitations, you can go a long way.
It's true. I mean, and also not being self-aware of pretty much everything. I mean, I don't think, again, the only time that Trump seems to be aware of his own, like, presence is when he's golfing.
Yeah, but so one of the lines in the Wolf book that kind of actually does fit some comments he's made over time, is that Trump can be self-deprecating at times. And it's always kind of unexpected.
That's what you read in the book, or is that what you...
No, I've seen comments from him over the past couple of years where he is that, and it always like is really weird. She's like, that's actually a little bit funny, and low bar here, but and it's mentioned in the book. I'm like, yeah, he does do that. Like, it's not about big things. It's like small stuff, like him talking about like his golf swing. I mean, he made the comment like, seems like it gets shorter every year or something, you know, but like some knowledge of his limitations. And it's so startling because like most of the time it doesn't seem as if he has any awareness of his own, like, not even failings, just his own like limitations in any regard. And he does have that, which is striking given how rarely he displays it.
Yeah. You know, well, let's go through the book because you have basically gotten some excerpts. I suffered for you guys here. I think our listeners really need to like hear some of these things just out of like pure transparency, like so that if they have to read it, they have an idea what they're going for.
Yeah, you don't have to read it. You can like take the Twitter takes and you've got a good idea. But this book really isn't a story. Like, it's not the story of the Trump administration. It's the story of Bannon in the Trump administration. And there are a lot of sources in the book. It's not just like, you know, Bannon writing stuff down, that going as the gospel. And it's not necessarily told from Bannon's point of view, but it is a Bannon-based book. This is a count. It starts with Bannon and it ends with Bannon leaving in August. And that's the end of the entire book, as if that's where the Trump's presidency ended.
Right.
The book is definitely not pro-Bannon. It's not endorsing Bannon. It's not, you know, cheering him on. And it's very critical of him in a lot of ways, talking about how disorganized he is, how like the idea that he could have been chief of staff is ridiculous because he couldn't be his own chief of staff. Like, he's so incapable of basic organizational skills that would never be an option in any universe. So it's harsh on him. And it always calls out, or often calls out, like his own limited view and his lack of actual knowledge of what he's doing. But at the same time, it does come off as pro-Bannon at points because his point of view is the predominant one. He's the main source. He's the main access that Wolf had.
Right.
So if there are times when there's an event happens and the only point of view you have is Bannon's point of view and you have to tell based on what knowledge you have, having all the information come through the lens of Bannon does tilt it in a certain way. I think a great example was about the travel ban and how that went down.
How did that go down?
According to Bannon, he sent Stephen Miller to the internet to look up how to write an EO.
Steve Miller, you said?
Yeah. He's like, hey, Miller, you're in charge of writing this travel ban EO. And I'm sure Miller's like, what's an executive order? And Bannon says, just go look on the internet and figure it out.
That's also very hard to believe because Steve Miller, and, you know, I am not a Steve Miller fan by any stretch of the means, but he arguably is the most nuanced on policy of any person in the Trump administration.
Just because
he worked for Jeff Sessions, he was his policy advisor. He's worked on the Hill for so long. It's very hard to say that he doesn't know that. And that's like one of those things where like, okay, what here is actually truth and what is fiction? Because like, you know, also Trump saying that he didn't know who John Boehner was, former Speaker of the House. Like, that's crazy considering the fact that they've golfed multiple times while he was Speaker of the House.
I cannot categorically say you're wrong. I cannot say for a fact that your claim that
that's just
Miller
one of
the
areas
is the most policy
guy. That's just one of the areas I'm very skeptical about because Steve Miller, as evil as you want to think of him as being, he's not a policy wonk.
In the Trump land, it's possible he is, but he is not by any objective measure a policy wonk. But here's the thing. He has no experience.
I think objectively he is actually a policy
He has
wonk.
No experience in executive orders whatsoever. So why would he have the skill set? And also, second, it failed miserably. It was a giant disaster that caused, and is still causing, lots and lots of litigation all over the U.S. So, actually, he did suck at it.
Oh, no, I'm not saying he didn't suck at it. I'm just saying he's probably a policy wonk who sucks at it.
But why would he know how to make an EO? I don't have any reason to disbelieve the idea that Stephen Miller went to the internet to look up how to write an executive order.
I mean, honestly, if there's one place that you would learn how to find out how to write an executive order, wouldn't it be on the internet where all the executive orders are posted?
Yeah. Let's be real. I would do the same thing. Someone told me to write an executive order. I'd be like, hello, Google.
That's the thing is, like, they were how many weeks into the actual being in the White House before they had to roll out this executive order? It was a week.
The point is, he's a novice and he didn't have any background knowledge to draw from.
I don't think many people who get into the White House are, you know, professionals and know how to do this stuff right off the bat.
Often, well, a lot of them are, but you do have people usually who are experienced in executive branch issues. But anyway, so here's like one of the parts of the book where I think it's clear that the whole Bannon narrative is shining through. According to Wolf's book, after the executive order comes out, there's like chaos, disaster, and things aren't going wrong, and it's not getting enforced, and everything's like in a mess. It says, quote, Steve Bannon was satisfied. He could not have hoped to draw a more vivid line between the two Americas, Trump's and liberals, and between his White House and the White House inhabited by those not yet ready to burn the place down. Why did we do this on a Friday when it would hit the airports hardest and bring out the most protesters? Almost the entire White House demanded to know. That's why, said Bannon. so the snowflakes would show up at the airports and riot. That was the way to crush the liberals, make them crazy and drag them to the left. Like, bull fucking shit. This is Bannon making his, like, own post-talk rationalization for why he screwed the pooch on this.
Yeah, I mean, like, getting them out in protest on a Friday night, I don't know why you would roll that out then and why you wouldn't roll it out in the middle of the week, but...
I don't think they had a plan. He's just spinning it off as if it was a strategy.
No, I mean, it was rolled out terribly. I mean, objectively, it was a horribly rolled out policy. They got, you know, airports and the Customs and Border Protection received zero to little guidance, as well as DHS, which is the controlling agency of CBP. They got almost no guidance on this, and they only found out about it as soon as basically as everyone else was kind of rolling, you know, learning about it, either via Twitter or via cable news.
Yeah, so now he's trying to claim, of course, that was the point. It was supposed to be chaos. And no, I don't believe that. I think that's just what he... I mean, that's a very handy rationalization to have if you screw up a lot. You're like, oh, actually, this is the time I meant to screw up.
Yeah, and again, like, that's another, like, point of skepticism where I make, or, you know, Bannon is trying to make himself... He's obviously lying. He'd be lying about it if he said that this was a intentional deal of his, was to try to make it look like, oh, that was on purpose. Of course I did that.
And because this is like a Bannon source book, there are a lot of gaps in sort of the narrative, and it's very limited in what it focuses on. And again, because as far as we've heard so far, like, Bannon was not involved in the Russia stuff. His name never comes up in it. And there's always a possibility he's a secret ninja that was doing it behind the scenes and pulling it off. As far as we know right now, this was not something Bannon was involved with or, like, wanting at any level. Which means the book doesn't really cover it in any way it's useful or eliminating. It's got a lot of that stuff wrong. Very sort of mistaken assumptions about what actually... like the various, like, Russian players, like what their motives were, what they're doing, like what Manafort's background was, like his relationship with Deripaska. Oh, there's one line about Sater. At some point, like, I need to check into it more, because there's a line about how Felix Sater supposedly got caught.
Who's Felix Sater? I'm ignorant to this guy.
Felix Sater is the Russian mobster who's been a business partner of his since, like, 2002. And he's also the CIA asset who told the CIA. He got convicted of some, like, you know, Wall Street stock scams, and he told the government that he could help them find Osama bin Laden Stinger missiles over in, like, Europe if they made him an informant. So they agreed, and he went on this, like, hunt for his Stinger missiles. I think he was all like, the CIA believed him. I don't believe him. I think he played them. Yeah, it's a long, involved story, and it gets crazier the more you get into it. But then he comes back and still is FBI informant, still in sentence. He starts working with Trump and has, like, money laundering schemes. He's dealing with Trump, which the FBI never acts on. I don't even know. Anyway, that's Felix Sater. But there's one line in the book where and it's clearly got to be from Bannon, who says, like, Felix Sater got caught running Russian money in Boca Raton. So there are some Boca connections. Some of his, like, stock scam partner, one of them at least, was based in Boca. I don't think I've ever seen anything about him getting caught running money for the Russians in Boca. And I forgot to look up into that. I need to look at that more, because I'm very curious about where the line came from. Again, it could just be, like, something that was made up by Bannon. But it also sounds like something that Sater might have gotten caught doing. So, but other than that, again, not much Russia stuff is worth. There is the one part about the legal spokesman, Mark Carollo, who quit back this summer. And supposedly, according to Wolf's book, he quit because it was right after the whole June 9th Trump Tower meeting came out. And while flying back from Europe, Trump on Air Force One dictates a statement to be issued by Don Jr. to the New York Times about the upcoming article. Supposedly, Carollo was...
And this is the article about him meeting with Natalia Veselnitskaya?
Yeah, the very first one. And okay. Trump dictated...
And that was a June 2016 meeting.
Oh, yeah.
It was what... It was Don Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort.
Yeah. And okay. That first statement that Don Jr. gave didn't come from Don Jr. Trump decided to say, like, oh, this meeting was primarily about adoptions.
Right,
and
yeah.
Some other nonsense.
Yeah, I remember that.
But apparently, Mark Carollo, the legal spokesman, thought this was obstruction of justice and quit. And if that's true, that's the most explosive claim in the entire book by far.
Interesting. Yeah, that hasn't really been reported on.
So
you're doing the Lord's work there, Susan.
There's
finding those nuggets.
Oh, that's been reported too, because it would be. I mean, everyone's, like, kind of skeptical about it because it is so explosive. You're like, okay, the gossip I can believe without sourcing.
Right.
But this claim, I, like, That's so big.
That needs to be fleshed out more before I think other outlets start really giving it much credence.
Like the bullshit gossip, I believe, because it's probably true, because we've all heard make the same comments.
And that's obviously been the most entertaining and wild, you know, like the juiciest bit about it is just the gossip.
And it's super boring, really, because I don't know. It's just like the pages of like Kellyanne Conway's beliefs on, like, I don't care in any universe what Kellyanne Conway feels about anything. I don't want to read this.
So a lot of it is, there are some excerpts and interviews with Kellyanne Conway?
Well, I don't think it was with her necessarily, but it's also like people talking about her motivations and why she did things and like why she made the moves she did. Uh-huh. And like eyes glaze. I was like flipping page. I'm like, nope, I have no room in my brain to know what motivated Kellyanne Conway.
Well, what's interesting is I'm actually still, you know, unsure what Kellyanne Conway's actual role in the White House is. I understand she's a special, you know, not special counsel, but she's a counselor to the president. What does that really entail? What is she actually advising him on policy? Does she have any like pet issues that she's trying to move forward on? And other than going on TV and being a mouthpiece for the administration, I can't think of much.
Wolf has a great line about how like no one really has a job because no one can actually do a job. Like no one actually knows what they're doing. So like no one really has jobs there for the most part because they're not capable of doing a job. So they're kind of just like floating around and trying to seize the day where they can. Like Ivanka doesn't really have anything she's supposed to be doing, but sometimes she like sees a moment to like seize the White House's like energy for the day and make it go in a direction. And they're all kind of just jostling for that sort of like momentary like attention grabbing of the president.
You just brought up Melania, and I just want to, do you really think she cried tears of sadness when Trump won the election?
I don't know if she cried, but I think she was miserable as hell. I think she was very much hoping that Trump lost. She was like, oh my God, it's my worst nightmare come true.
Oh my God. But
she may have cried. I would have cried. Like I thought, I fully 100% believe that she was devastated by the win. And if you look at Don Jr.'s photographs of Trump at his win, he looks like a man who's seen a ghost.
Don Jr.?
He took photos of Trump when like the win was kind of came through. And Donald Trump, his father, he looks terrified. He looks like he's gotten the worst news of his entire life.
Well, I think they all really did think they were going to lose.
Yeah, and but he was not cheering. His reaction was not to cheer. It was like, oh, God.
I think he thought, you know, worst case scenario, and this is what he really mentally prepared himself for, was that, you know, he was going to lose and he was going to make a ton of money because of it. Mm-hmm. And that ended up not happening. And now he's faced with a change in lifestyle where he actually has to run an entire country and arguably the most, you know, a world power. Yeah, I'd probably be a little bit shocked too about that.
You see the schedule? He's not doing all that much. But no, I agree. I don't think he was like sad to lose. I think the only one who was actually upset about it was probably Melania. And I think she was devastated. But I think everyone else was like in shock and kind of scared, but not sad to have lost. But going back to the one sort of Russia stuff anecdote in the whole book, really, it's about the June 9th meeting and from, you know, Bannon's perspective. And it doesn't say this, I don't think. It doesn't actually, Bannon never actually comes out and like says this in words. But I think he either was the one who leaked the June 9th meeting to the media, or he really wants you to believe that he was.
Well, I mean, the way it sounds like, and this is just because Trump is trying to cut Bannon like a bad habit, is that he, as well as probably Reince Priebus and Mooch, although Mooch probably didn't do this because I don't think that he was there for such a short period of time that I don't think he had the capability of leaking the story, but essentially all the leaks probably came from those three people.
Oh, they were all leaking. They all leaked all the time. Trump leaked all the time. They all
leaked. But I think those are the principal, I think those are the major leakers in addition to obviously Trump, who leaked a lot of things.
Yeah. Oh, no, it was, John Miller and John Barron. They're terrible leakers.
John Miller and John Barron.
If you like leggings, you really need to try out Fabletics. These are the world's best leggings in terms of performance, quality, and definitely in style. Fabletics is fashionable, premium activewear at great value. Also, the best way to shop is becoming a VIP member. Members earn rewards and save 40 to 50% off retail prices. They have leggings in all sizes from XX small to 3X, and best yet, they have them in petite, regular, and tall lengths. And every month, Fabletics releases cool new styles, It's definitely something to look forward to. You go on the website, check it out, and decide if you want to buy something. And if not, no sweat. Just skip the month and pay nothing. I'm also a huge fan of their yoga pants. No, I don't do yoga. I can't do yoga. Doesn't work. But I really like the pants, and they don't judge me for it. So if you want to check out other legging styles, go on fabletics.com/45th. You'll get two pairs of their amazing leggings for just $24 when you become a VIP member. Seriously, these are the world's best leggings. They're a $99 value, and you'll get two for only $24 when you join at fabletics.com/45th. That's fabletics.com/45th. So if it's, and again, it's hard to tell if this is Bannon wanting to seem more important or if he really did this, but if Bannon leaked the June 9th meeting, that to me is really interesting. It makes a lot of sense because, well, he like really hates Kushner and also the whole Jew thing. But Bannon, despite recent appearances, is not self-destructive and pure chaos. He's like half chaos, half scheming. And there's no world in which he benefited, even if Kushner got hurt, which was, you know, always a plus. He never benefits from that information getting out and really undermines Trump presidency. And it makes me wonder how strategic it might have been. I mean, and I use that term loosely to mean, like, from Bannon's point of view, but it seems like it could have been kind of like Nixonian modified limited hangout going on. Whereby telling about the June 9th meeting, which was a footnote, you avoid or misdirect attention away from all the real dangers going on in the world, in the Trump world, like, you know, the meetings in May with the NRA, or later meetings in Europe with Papadopoulos. So just a theory there. But as part of that whole like section of the book, Bannon basically accused them of being, accused like Don Jr. and Manafort and Kushner of being like treasonous and stupid and all kinds of things. And he's totally right. He's not like wrong in the slightest. that was the stupidest damn idea in the whole history of the world. Like, why would you ever do that? Even if you wanted to collude with Russia, why would you do this? Because you're an idiot. So Bannon's not wrong, but he was very harsh in how he put it. And this morning, actually, he walked it back.
Yeah, Sunday morning, he's now apologized.
Yeah, he said his comments about the treason were, quote, aimed at Paul Manafort, a seasoned campaign professional with experience and knowledge of how the Russians operate. He should have known they were duplicitous, cunning, and not our friends. To reiterate, wow. Those comments were not aimed at Don Jr.
Wow, who's the cuck now?
They're all the cucks. And this is, okay, first of all, like, the whole defense is, like, Don Jr. is just too ignorant to collude with Russia. He didn't know how duplicitous they were. Like, it doesn't mean he didn't intend to. It just means he was too stupid to see what has happened to him. And it's also not really an apology either. I mean, he called, like, Don, he said Don Jr., and this is the book, quote, they're going to crack Don Jr. like an egg on national TV. That was a little bit aimed at Don Jr.
Yeah. I mean, I think Bannon's comments the first time around were the real Bannon. And right now he's trying to keep his job at Breitbart because there's a hard push to kick him out after joining it only 4 months ago after he left the Trump administration. So yeah, he's speaking from the point of cover your ass. How do I maintain my relevancy and power within the conservative media sphere? Because right now he has a show on SiriusXM radio. And in addition to basically running a website that even he acknowledges is probably not as legitimate as many other publications, which apparently was revealed in the book. So, you know, what happens from there? What does Bannon do if he gets kicked out of Breitbart, which, you know, may or may not happen?
Yeah. His real audience is not Trump. It's Rebecca Mercer.
Right. And that's the main funder of Breitbart, and they pulled all their funding. So now he's got, I did hear that he's running into the arms of a Chinese billionaire to try to get funding. But I think the
copycat,
the
that's Kushner's move.
I think the board of, and given the fact that only happened a few months after, you know, that Gabriel Sherman piece went out in which Bannon, he was traveling with Bannon to Japan to give an anti-China speech. So think of like the rich irony that that is. But yeah, if Bannon gets kicked out of Breitbart, what happens next for him? And to be honest, he's probably just going to have to start his own venture and find a new funder.
Yeah. I also put under file under things I don't care about.
Yeah.
Bannon goes after this.
I don't know. I'm more, I guess I'm
inside baseball. Yeah.
Yeah, it's inside baseball. I'm just interested in like all that stuff, I guess.
Yeah. And it, well, it should be noted, okay, this is definitely a Bannon based book, but Bannon's not the only source. And I think my favorite take on the whole thing, or a favorite like background story, is a tweet from Janice Min, who was, you know, knows Wolf and was, you know, involved at, not involved, but she was aware of what was going on when it's all being researched and learned about. And she tweeted that she would often ask Michael Wolf about his, like, weekly visits to the White House unsupervised. Mm-hmm. And she'd say, like, so what do they think you're doing there? And he told her, I have no idea. No one asks.
Which, oh, my God.
It's, yeah. And it's because this guy went on TV and, like, trashed the fake news for always, like, being negative about Donald Trump. And the Trump White House is like, yeah, this is our man. Let's bring him in and let him, like, hear everything we want to say to him. Because clearly he's one of us who will never betray us. And it worked. But let's let's all come back, I guess, to the central thesis or the central issue of the Wolf book.
What's
and
that?
That's Trump's mental fitness.
I knew we were
no,
come
it
to
is it. Though. Like, that's where it all comes. Like, there's nothing really that groundbreaking in the book, except it puts the question front and center: is this the move of a man who is mentally all there?
So, what did the book reveal?
People in the White House are questioning, just really like they're like, I mean, he won the election, so I guess he can't be a total idiot. But his stories are repetitive, going in with circles. He has no comprehension of any kind of detailed policy issue. There's debates on whether he's actually literate or just semi-literate. He won't read a briefing paper. He has no attention span for anything. And for a meeting with him, you spend 54 minutes hearing him tell the same story, probably three times a piece for each story. And then you have 6 minutes to try and get your point of view through. And it's the first time someone's actually addressed the elephant in the room, which is like, flat out, this guy might actually not be mentally competent.
Well, again, that's mentally competent is different from being mentally unstable, which I don't actually fully believe he is mentally unstable. I believe he's a narcissist. I believe he's self-centered. And I believe he's only interested in things that have to do with him. And he's not interested. He's just disinterested about anything else that has to do with anything but him.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is enough to be, I don't think I can be an armchair psychiatrist and say that this guy's mentally unstable just because he hates talking policy and he's disinterested in anything that doesn't involve himself and he likes repeating stories. Like, I know people who are mentally stable who repeat stories to me all the time and it's very annoying, but they do it multiple times and not realizing that all the story, you know, not realizing who they've told stories to.
But so, they impulsively, like, threaten nuclear war on Twitter.
Well, they're not leaders of the free world, are they?
Do they also tweet that now that Russian collusion, after 1 year of intense study, has proven to be a total hoax in the American public, Democrats, lapdogs, rah-rah-rah, mainstream news, fake news, rah-rah-rah. I'm super throughout my life. My two greatest assets have been my mental stability and being, like, really smart. Like,
being like
Hillary
really
Clinton
smart.
Also played these cards very hard, as everyone knows, went down in flames.
I will say this. I don't think he's so much unstable as he is insecure. I think he's very insecure.
That's unquestionably true.
But,
so, like, I agree with you, because here, like, I'm really not interested in the question of whether, I guess what the thesis, or the question people are talking about now is whether he has, like, Alzheimer's or dementia, or if he's declining that way. And I just don't think that's the relevant question, because I don't know if you could distinguish between organic Alzheimer's and, you know, organic mental brain change or whatever, or just the reactions of an inherently unstable narcissist under intense pressure and fear.
Who's also aging. I mean, he may not have dementia or early onset Alzheimer's, but, you know.
But it
when you get
matter.
Up, when you get up in years, I mean, you start, you know, he's been doing the same thing for how long?
Yeah, whether he's having an actual, like, organic change in his brain or not, that's just, who cares? Because he's manifestly incompetent right now.
And also, I think right now, he's finally been able, or this might be the first time in his life that he's surrounded with people who have been telling him no. I think for his entire life, he's only been surrounding himself with yes men. And that's probably a big, big blow to his, not only to his ego, but to how he has run things his entire life.
Yeah. And at the same time, knowing the kind of person he is, if he had Alzheimer's, could you really tell?
I mean, I hate being an armchair psychiatrist or, you know, diagnostician, but, you know, I would not rule those things out, uh-huh. But I think I think with congressional Democrats and some people in the media immediately reaching to that conclusion.
They're not reaching it. They're raising questions. They're definitely not concluding that. And I am somewhat sympathetic too, because I thought it's not worth debating, because like, look at the man who he is. Whether he has Alzheimer's or not, he's equally incapable of performing the job. But sometimes reading old like deposition transcripts from Trump from like in the early 2000s or even earlier, you're reading it and it's hard to tell, just because in that setting, in a deposition, he was more focused and competent and like able to, you know, focus on certain things. But he does sound like a different person. And it's a little bit disconcerting to see him make a very rational and coherent point, again, judged by a low bar. And he does not do those things now. He's not talking this way that he was once capable of doing.
I don't know. I mean, like, Donald Trump back in 2014, October 2014, tweeted, "I am starting to think that there is something seriously wrong with President Obama's mental health. Why won't he stop the flights? Psycho! Exclamation point. Like, that, I think it's inappropriate for him to question former President Obama's mental health, just like I think it's inappropriate to question Donald Trump's mental health. Well, I think in relation to consistency.
Yeah. Also, that was about Ebola, too. That was like him saying, like, how could you? I don't think he was actually questioning. Well, it was more like, he's such a germaphobe. He's like, oh my God, how could you not do everything you possibly can not to get Ebola out? It would be insane not to.
I mean, everyone has a reason for questioning each other's mental stability. I just don't think it's without knowing conclusive evidence that the president of the United States is mentally unstable. I don't think we should be, one, debating it, and two, reaching that conclusion right off the bat without, you know, saying, you know, President Trump has a mental illness from an actual professional, clinically licensed professional.
Well, there are people a lot of professionals actually come forward who have said, you're going to see more deterioration, you're going to see more of this impulsivity. And again, I'm not saying he does have Alzheimer's. I don't really have an opinion on another. I also don't think it matters, because again, whether or not he has Alzheimer's, he is equally incompetent. But I don't think that's the thing.
I think he's incompetent, but I don't think he's mentally unstable.
Well, it does. So, okay, are you saying we shouldn't even question his ability to perform the job, or shouldn't question specifically?
No, you can question his ability to perform the job. There are plenty of people who are mentally stable who are simply incompetent and can't perform a job. That's one thing. Being mentally unstable is completely different.
Okay. So here is, in response to all the questions about his mental acuity, his friend, Chris Ruddy, from Newsmax, who was at Mar-a-Lago and saw Trump over the holidays, was telling CNN that Trump is psychologically fit, and here's his justification for that. "I conversed with him numerous times. I saw him interact with people. He was remembering things. He was on point. He could follow up on discussions."
I mean, like, the thing is, like, all this hearsay, defense and attacks on him, I think, are pretty much baseless. I don't buy anyone's opinion unless it's someone who actually evaluates him in a professional psychiatric setting, rather than just saying, "Oh, he's done this, he's done X, he's done Y, therefore he is this."
Well, given Trump's doctor, I'm not sure we can rely on anything he has in a medical report.
I mean, I will say that he is probably incompetent and probably doesn't know what he's doing. But that is completely different from saying he is mentally unstable. But I did get a lot of, I did chuckle at the whole very stable genius statement from him. That was pretty funny.
Again, would an actual stable genius tweet that?
I don't know. Again, I think someone who's insecure would tweet that.
That's true. How can you distinguish intense insecurity and narcissism from dementia? It just can't be done.
Well, I think there are plenty of people who are not narcissistic, or they are they're not narcissistic, and I think plenty of people who have dementia don't think that way.
Yeah.
I think they probably reassure themselves that they still have it. I don't think they have to reassure everybody else that they still have it. But then again, I could be completely wrong about any of this.
And at the end of the day, whether he impulsively destroys the world because that's just who he is, or because he has some kind of...
It's probably because of who he is.
Yeah. It's because who he is. So on that happy note, that will sum up this week's The 45th. Any closing thoughts, Siraj?
Yes. I would just say that be skeptical of everything. Don't believe everything at face value, and you should be good to go.
And you can probably skip the Michael Wolff book. Oh, and also some news from Tom Rogan, who's been a guest on the show.
Oh, yeah, yes, yes. Closing out on the show, Tom Rogan, a good buddy of mine. He's a colleague of mine at the Washington Examiner. He's been on the 45th podcast with us for multiple times, even before me. And the McLaughlin Group, which had been a cable news show, have been running for 29 years from the 1980s until John McLaughlin's passing in August of 2016, has just been renewed for a six-month episode run. And it actually debuted this past weekend on Sunday in the Washington, D.C. area. Look for a clip online. It should be on YouTube if you're a big McLaughlin Group fan. And I actually made an appearance in March 2016, thanks to Tom. So I just want to wish him and the entire crew congratulations. That includes Clarence Page, Pat Buchanan, Eleanor Clift, and their special guest, Evan McMullen. You should check it out online. That's the McLaughlin Group.
So don't miss it. And we'll see y'all next week.
Take it easy.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.